Good evening. Very nice to see you. Sorry we were running a couple of moments late. It's quite disturbing. I'm standing here looking at a monitor which has got Tony Blair speaking in the House of Commons. So I'll try and ignore that. First of all, I'm David Putman. I'm your chair for this evening. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here for what I think is a fairly important and very, very timely debate. Social and economic changes over the past few decades have fundamentally transformed the world of work. The large local employer, the 9 to 5 working day, the male breadwinner, and the job for life, all of these are essentially things of the past. They've been replaced by a new series of buzzwords: downsizing, lifelong learning, employability, flexible working, portfolio careers, and teleworking. That's just to name a few of them. And of course, in deference to my old school chum, Tony Giddings, globalization. In this brave new world of the future, I suspect that jobs will increasingly go to those with the skills to teach machines to do the dullest of human work, and to those with the skills to accomplish things that the most sophisticated machines cannot yet quite manage. Our future prosperity, both as individuals and as a nation, lies not in our raw materials or our physical strength, but in our brains. It's my hope that in this evening's discussion, we can start to unravel some of the consequences of these changes and unravel the meanings behind the buzzwords, focusing on one issue in particular: our aging society. Like the rest of Europe, Britain is getting older. In 1961, just under 12% of the population were aged 65 and over. By 1994, this had increased to 16%. In contrast, the population aged under 16 fell from a quarter in 1961 to around a fifth in 1994. And this trend is expected to continue so that in 2030, just a little over 30 years' time, those aged 65 and over are expected to make up about 23% of the population, whilst those under 16 will comprise a little less than 18%. And all of this indicates that in the next few decades, there will be fewer people of working age to support the incomes of tomorrow's pensioners. So how will this demographic shift, together with all the other social, economic, and technological changes that are now taking place, how will all this affect our working lives and those of our children, or in my case at least, my grandchildren? Technological change is revolutionizing the way we live and work. The sheer scale of these changes would have been unimaginable even 15 years ago, when even the humble fax machine was a relatively rare sight in the vast majority of offices. Anyone who doubts the extent and the sheer rapidity of these technological changes has only to read through the pages of this informative and extremely timely report in order to get a sense of the way in which communication technology is extending deeper and deeper into every single nook and cranny of our working lives. Predicting the future is never easy, especially when the future has such a very uncertain shape. And it's all too easy to become skeptical or even a little complacent about the impact of technology in the workplace. For instance, Thomas Watson, then chairman of IBM, was a touch pessimistic when he said in 1943, "I think there's a world market for maybe 5 computers." Now, 40 years on, it's easy to scoff, but we need to be absolutely sure that we're not found to have been equally guilty of the same myopia and the same sort of complacency. It should be obvious that our workforce must be properly trained and confident in the use of IT, that training must start in our schools, and that those schools in turn must be equipped with up-to-the-minute and very sophisticated computing equipment. Equipment which can help provide children with the technological and communication skills that will increasingly be essential to their futures and to our success as a modern trading nation. The boundaries between work, education, and unpaid voluntary activity are becoming very blurred. Gone are the days of the set but comforting pattern of education, followed by work, followed by retirement. Increasingly, individuals have to adapt to the very rapidly changing demands of the job market. Developments in IT are creating virtual workplaces, which could allow more and more people to work from home, or indeed anywhere, eventually possibly doing away with the whole notion of travelling to work. So our future working lives could well come to consist of intermingling periods of education and training, paid work, and unpaid social involvement. And this throws an extraordinary challenge to policymakers. How can we provide for such a varied pattern of work? What will these changes mean for the non-working aspects of our lives, including our families and our leisure time? And how can we ensure that people have the opportunities to be able to act flexibly to meet the demands of this future workplace? Many of these changes will never affect this present generation of workers. Thousands of workplaces up and down the country are still working according to very traditional methods and models. But the future patterns of work are already emerging. And I think we owe it to society to start thinking through our medium and our long-term response to these changes and the very real spectre of insecurity that they offer. So it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speakers, who will offer us their particular perspective on the future of work. On my immediate left, Lorna Fitzsimmons, MP for Rochdale, who will consider the role of women in the changing job market, and particularly from the government's perspective. To her left, Alec Reid from Reid International, who will speak from an employer's perspective. To his left, Natasha Andrews from Unison, who will talk about the future workforce, and arriving on the platform at the most immaculate timing, thank you, David, is David Lee, Assistant General Secretary of the TUC, who will provide the employee's perspective. Can I start with you, Alec, to talk about the employer's perspective of all this change?
I have this effect on computers. It's going to make me redundant if it doesn't work. Try start.
Yes, you can.
Thank you very much. Thank you, David. One of the problems of having a common name like Reid is you get the wrong companies attributed to you. Actually, it's not Reid International. I wish it was. It's about 500 times bigger than my little operation. I'm the founder and chairman of Reid Executive, which is, I hope you know, an employment agency. And I've been doing that. I started the company in 1960. I've been doing that for almost 40 years. And I was trying to think on the way here this afternoon how many people I've employed. And I got up to 100,000, and then I couldn't remember any more names. But I think at the moment, it depends what you call employ. The government are very anxious for us to call our temporaries our employees. So we have about 25,000 temporaries and about 1,500 of our own staff. Well, having been an employment agent for nearly 40 years, I must say it's only the last 5 years that have got really exciting. There's been enormous change in the last 5 years. And when you think of the economy generally, genetics, computers, satellites, digitalization, telephones, the internet. I mean, I just imagine if the economy was human, it would have had a mental breakdown by now. But instead of that, it's passing it on to us. And with all this change about, I've taken the opportunity of having a few ideas, and they're very fragile ideas, so I would ask you to handle them very gently when it comes to any debate. I like to call them work in progress. In 10 minutes' time, you might think of them more as half-baked. If I had a blackboard, I'd like now to draw a line on it, a simple graph from left to right, and it would be maybe the average increase in wages or the average wage of what is called the labour force. And if we took it at value, then we'd think all is well. I mean, we're going in the right way. Wages aren't inflationary, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, that average conceals some very worrying trends. And with a blackboard, I would then draw one line going through the roof and the other going through the floor. The one going through the roof would be what I call the best paid, I suppose, for now. And the one going through the bottom would be the worst paid. And as we all know, they're polarizing. I mean, I've been drawing this graph from some years now, and I've never overestimated the situation as it's turned out to be. This is a little slide that shows what I think has probably happened over the years. Obviously, in the agriculture age, there was tremendous demand for manpower, and it shrunk almost to nothing in this country. There's very little opportunities for people just to offer that. At the same time, the demand for brains is just going through the roof. And I call where we are now the creative age. Other people I know call it the knowledge age, but I think knowledge isn't enough, that we must be in the creative age. And the other side of a creative age, however, is a destructive age. So everything that's created tends to destroy something at the other end of the scale, or not even the other end. I was looking at a very nice camera I bought maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it's very undesirable now. I've now got an Ixus, and I believe that's getting pretty tired. And everything changes so rapidly, and it's taking a lot of destruction in its way. And so I think somebody at the LSE ought to rethink labour market and really destroy that term, and we ought to think in terms of two markets maybe, and for the want of a better name, the brain power market or the abilities market and the old style manpower market. And it occurs to me that in the agriculture age, the weightings, I mean, I did study economics once, the principles of, it was for an accountant examination, and the only thing I remember were the three factors of production. And they were drummed in, I don't know if they're still drummed in at the LSE, but they were certainly drummed in at the City of London College where I studied. But nobody talked about weightings, but I felt it's reasonable to do so. And so in the agriculture age, I've weighted land. That must have been the most important factor of production. So I've weighted that 6, labour 1, and capital 3. In the industrial age, land became less valuable, labour a little more valuable, and capital very valuable. So I've weighted that 6. But now it seems to me, in the creative age, land is very unvaluable. Labour, and I called it their brain power, a certain type of labour, I'm getting hung up by my own criticism of the labour market, is very, very valuable indeed. And capital isn't very valuable. And I think that capitalism is on the way out, and peopleism is on the way in. I mean, I heard some economic professors speaking at a conference I was at last week, and they talked about late capitalism. I hadn't heard the term before, but I thought they'd missed a point. It should be the late capitalism. I've got graduate trainees to produce these slides for me. I thought, after a hard day's work, you might appreciate a few pictures. And they were, I think, finishing up their Easter eggs, because this one is based on eggs, and it's the way it was and still is in many places, that white males were preferred, then white females, ethnic minorities, disabled, and then people like me, too old, and others maybe too young. And it was because it was that way, there was a need for an Equal Opportunity Commission to be created, and partly that was the need for the Committee for Racial Equality to be introduced, and many campaign groups were formed. In fact, Age Concern have been very active in campaigning for my group. Refugees campaign for jobs for the refugees, the disabled for the disabled. But now, it seems to me that discrimination is a luxury that employers can no longer afford. And the sooner they find that out, if they haven't done so already, the better. Because I think this is the way it is now, and it depends on one's, I call it economic ability, and the most highly valued, we've called megheads, are earning fantastic rates of pay every day. I mean, I don't bother to change this slide now, because every day a new record is broken. I'm studying it very closely, and every day somebody comes up with a bigger salary than was paid yesterday. And we did have to change the bottom slow earners to with the introduction of the minimum wage. But in fact, I'd started only, well, within a year, I had a pound in that column, and I'd identified some employees that were paid a pound an hour. But of course, we hope they're not any longer. And so we hear about a long tail of achievers, and that is obviously a very real problem. I think what's very encouraging with any discrimination that's hanging around is that in future, to find these people, we will have to rely much more on testing. On the previous slide, you just had to look and you knew what they were, really. I mean, interviews, so, you know, you go through a process of interviews, but if you've ever talked to a personnel manager, they will confirm that research has shown that people make up their mind within the first 3 minutes of an interview where they're going to employ somebody. So really, what we're doing mainly is looking. But now, it's much more complicated. We've got to get a bit more intelligent. So I see great progress in testing, which and testing, intelligent testing and developed testing will be non-discriminatory. The two problems here that I see is mobilising the brain power. We haven't got enough of it to compete internationally. We've got to get much, much more. And the other problem is engaging the manpower. How do we keep people engaged in the economy that have different skills? How can we develop those different skills? How can we demand more? How can we give more to these people? How can we give them more opportunities? And it's not always done, I feel, by protection. Sometimes protection does more harm than good. I was in a job centre last week talking to a woman who was 58. She said she was overqualified as a teacher. I didn't believe her, so I continued to discuss her CV, and she said, yes, I am overqualified because I've got 3 degrees, and as a teacher with 3 degrees, I'm paid high up on the scale, and no school can afford or wants to pay me that. I personally would be willing to accept a salary further down the scale, but that's not possible. And so with peopleism and capitalism, it's the late capitalism, as I said, but as I've also shown out, there's some peopleism. There's a mountain of money in the world. Money has very little value. Interest hardly covers inflation now. And if you're anything like I am, every day somebody wants to lend you some money. You open the mail and somebody wants, you know, they're getting more and more. I saw the Woolwich tonight saying that I only had to phone up there and then, tell them everything I owed everybody and everything would be all right. They'd pay it all off for me, and of course, then I'd pay the woodage. So there's a mountain of money. It's looking for homes. It's desperate to get into shares. That's why shares are so highly valued, if not overvalued. And it cannot cope, in my theory, with the massive changes that are about at the moment. Capitalism isn't flexible. And so now, without a doubt, people are the distinguishing feature of success. And you have many companies now, successful companies, that are brain rich and capital poor. But those companies are very, very difficult to manage. Some chief executives describe their employees as their biggest asset. It's rather misleading. They're not only an asset, they can be a contingent liability, I can tell you. And they are difficult to manage. They are not your asset. They're not an employer's assets at all. They are their own people. And so whereas there's minimal interest attracted by capital, we're reading about sky-high salaries, and I say, why not? If successful CEOs, for me, are stars in the same way as stars that appear on television or stars that appear on a football pitch, and if we want entrepreneurial management, then we've got to be prepared to pay entrepreneurial salaries. So the good news is that capitalism is dead. Long live peopleism. Thank you.
Thank you, Alec, very, very much indeed. Lorna. Suck 'em dead.
Don't know about anybody else, but I quite like some capital. So if you want to give me some Alec, because you're into people, then I'm quite happy. I think the bit that I have been given in terms of looking at particularly the role of women means that I would probably change what Alec had done and go for girl power, really, and say that the defining thing about the change in the last 20 years and hopefully the change in the next 20 years is the role of women in work and women in society. I think that I've put down as grandiosely having the government's view, and I'd like to dissuade you of anything that I'm going to say tonight. It is the government's view. This is my perspective as the chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party Women's Group, and something that we've been grappling with is to square the conundrum between home and work, which I think has really defined the last 20 years and will define the next 20 years if we're going to get social society or whatever the new buzzwords are to actually really work and to actually make the some people something to people something in terms of actually making it work for everybody wherever they are within the diagrams that Alex showed or whatever diagrams there are in the future. And I think the government has actually been taken it really seriously in terms of looking at the conundrum of the role of families and work, because the reality is that if you have employment practices that mean that you destabilise families, that you can't plan, that you don't get stability, that you are on a 0 hours contract, that you don't know whether you're going to be paid that week, it does actually put stresses and strains on the family, it does alter the upbringing, the future perspective of children, you name it. Therefore, to actually look at the world of family as well as the world of work together seems like an economically sensible thing to do as well as a socially humane and sensible thing to do. And the government with the two budgets, and I'm glad to say that Gordon has really got girl power. We've got loads more women in the Treasury, and hence quite a lot of the things that you've seen in the budget that are actually looking at making work pay for working families, which benefit the lower income range, which are women and children, that were currently on the cusp of whether benefit actually paid, and whether people actually therefore were brought up in families where there had been any pattern of work, or whether, as there are in lots of Rochdale homes, where there are three generations of families in the same home where there has been no experience of work at all. The women's unit was established 18 months ago, and it's situated in the heart of government, the Cabinet Office. We decided it didn't work being in an offshoot of a Whitehall department. We'd go straight to government, and we're now in the enlarged Cabinet Office. And boy, does the rest of Whitehall know it. And on the 9th of November, the government launched its new initiative for women, Better for Women, Better for All. And I personally think that that's just common sense. And it's just to actually look at some of the things over the past 18 months that the government has actually started to look at, and therefore giving you an idea of how seriously this debate of the age is taken in terms of the role of women, the role of families in the economy and in society, if we're going to actually tackle some of the problems that we see, not only in being competitive in the egghead age through globalisation, etc., but also if we're going to make our communities work, if we're going to make it for us and for our families. And some of the things that are included are the introduction of things called family-friendly employment policies. The debate, and it will be interesting to see what David's got to say, but very much when we came to power, the debate on employment rights was very much the barons, i.e. the male trade union barons versus the male business barons. A couple of women that were in the cabinet at the time saw a real chance to actually get something totally different on the agenda that met everybody's needs to get away from this unseemly squabble, which was family-friendly policies. We seem to have therefore stolen a march in terms of actually changing the agenda. And the new approach in terms of protection and safety of women, the first ever national childcare strategy, increasing child benefit, legislation to allowing pensions to be shared at divorce, childcare strategy, violence against women. There are lots of different things. And when you look at the national minimum wage and women being the main beneficiaries of the national minimum wage, lone parents, New Deal, actually looking at a lot of the young people, lone parents in my constituency that wanted to work but couldn't, primarily because of the childcare situation, where they could make work pay, but not if they had to actually afford childcare. And actually doing the simple logistics of thinking in people's lives and people's circles, was something that's going to revolutionise the capital, as it were, of those particular women that have been trained. They weren't actually unqualified women. They just couldn't get out of this circle where childcare was the equation that nobody ever had really bothered about before. There are lots of other things, the Working Families Tax Credit, for example, trying to actually make work pay rather than actually having to balance the books through a benefit. Now, most of you, and some of you will be far more eminent than I, will know that the proportion of women in the labour force has increased dramatically over the last 20 years and is likely to continue. In 1971, women made up 83% of the workforce compared with 44% in 1996. And over 12 million women aged 16 or over are economically active in Great Britain, just over half of all the women. Over two-fifths of women of working age in the United Kingdom have dependent children. One in five of these women is a lone parent, hence the importance of childcare and all the lone parent strategies that the government has started to, post-lone parent benefit, won't talk about that, to actually start to get right. In 1997, the average hourly earnings of women in full-time employment was £7.88, just 80% of the average male earnings, which are £9.82. And the average weekly earnings were £297.20, which is 73% of the average male earnings. So you can see that even though we've got Equal Pay Act, etc., there is still a gap in terms of male average earnings and female average earnings. 80% of part-time workers are women, and 44% in employment work part-time. Now, women's skills, the interesting thing that we've learnt over doing all the stuff over the New Deal for Lone Parents, because there was scepticism about, you know, you wonder if you've spent 16 years out looking after a staggered family, as it were, in childbirth terms, how employable you are, is women have traditionally been employed in more non-manual occupations. 70% currently work in these areas. Men are evenly split between manual and non-manual. And yet women actually are multi-skilled. Now, I would say this, wouldn't I, being a girly? And all the women in the audience, I hope you agree. But especially if you have a family, then flexibility and adaptability and organisational skills and time management skills are the name of the game, or else it just doesn't work. And employers are starting to realise that. And it was really fascinating looking at some of the pilot study results of how employers suddenly started to do a skills audit of looking at the employability of the women and suddenly realised they could organise an army. Women's skills are going to be very important, I would contend, in actually the creative industries that we're talking about and the type of workforces that more is going to be in the wealth creation industries. Therefore, that's why I would contend that, yes, we have been the changing pattern in the last 20 years, and I think we're going to be women's role in the economy. If we get the flexible employment patterns of home and work right and acknowledge the issue of childcare, are also going to play a hugely revolutionary part. Now, if you look at the attainment levels in schools in terms of girls, then this is corroborated, because in my constituency it definitely is girl power. We definitely have a huge problem with unattainment, especially of white young men. In my constituency as well, we have a huge unemployment problem with Asian young men, not black, but Asian young men as well. So it's not just, I think, a white young male issue. But women's educational attainment is improving in recent years, and the number of women students has increased faster in recent years than men. 49% growth for women compared to 38% growth for men. And the labour market, obviously, is, as I've said, over the past 20 years has changed dramatically. The shift away from manufacturing and the primary industries to business and the service industries has been in women's favour, as you've seen. Men have borne the brunt of the unemployment, whilst women are responsible for responding to the flexible workforce. And 3.5 million manufacturing jobs have been lost since 1971. Men have accounted for 2.5 million of those jobs. So in terms of unemployment, it's definitely a male characteristic. And actually, part-time, more flexible work patterns are more of a female characteristic. It makes sense to people, but it's something that I think will actually determine the employment future in terms of men and women. Now, one of the big things is obviously training of women, both in terms of reskilling on the job, as it were, and also reskilling after breaks, whether it's a career break in terms of children or whether it is a career break in terms of carers, because women also tend to spend more time actually being carers of elderly relatives or disabled children than actually men in the workforce. And the more that we actually deal with the issue of carers, the issue of retraining, the issue of reskilling, you are therefore going to see an increase in the capital and the deployment of capital of women. The Equal Opportunities Commission have recently made several recommendations. Most of them are actually based around training in non-traditional areas where women are underrepresented or where there's a skills shortage, so that we can actually start through training to direct that very flexible, very able workforce into the skills niches that all my employers are saying are wanting at the moment. And it's just actually meeting that need. Now, obviously, parenthood and family-friendly employment policies, as I've said, are something that we are, I think, particularly proud that we've put on the map. But if you look at the change since the Second World War, there has been a total change in terms of the conflicting demands of work and home. The old pattern, as Alec was saying, of 9-to-5, male, big industries, women responsible for the children, it just doesn't bear any resemblance to the communities that we now represent and work in. And it's been superseded by a variety of family patterns and women's hugely increased participation in employed employment. In 1975, 90% of families were headed by a married or cohabiting couple. By 1995, that figure had dropped to 78%. And parenthood affects men and women differently. Fathers continue to work in full-time and often longer hours than women, and therefore the Working Time Directive is going to, if we get it right, there's a few quirks in there, I think, but is going to vastly change the balance in terms of parenthood, both in terms of the stuff that we're doing over a parental leave directive and allowing paternity leave, but also actually making, with the Working Families Tax Credit, it's actually financially possible for lower income families to make a choice of doing less hours but keeping the same income and therefore being able to stay home. So you will actually get a more reasonable share rather than the patterns of work that we've been having, where we have got men having to work longer hours for less pay in the UK than anywhere else in Europe. And we wonder then why we have got parenting problems of men not reading and role models and you name it. So as we see the introduction of all these measures that are going to kick in, most of them this year, you are actually going to see, I think, a small revolution in terms of the balance between men and women, both in the home and parenting, and with childcare, obviously, responsibilities, also women in work. I could go on, but I won't, because the reality is that I'm sold on it. I hope you're sold on it. I think women are the force for the future. I think they're also the economic force and also the social force, because if we get the social framework right, the regulatory framework right, and actually enable businesses to successfully implement a lot of the social policies that we have powered through over the last 2 years, we will genuinely revolutionise that gel between home and work, which will mean that you ain't seen nothing yet in terms of women in the world of work, and allowing women to not only be successful in terms of home, as we have been for the past 20 years, but also play our full role and actually revolutionise the world of work as well, as I think we should. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Lorna. You may not have been speaking on behalf of the government, but I watched very carefully. Your bleeper didn't go off once.
It's because it's in my bag.
Ah, that's it. Pleased to know a very, very prescient priest when I was working on the mission 12 years ago. We were talking about the future of the Catholic Church, and he said that it would be decided by the nuns, that only the nuns really understood where the Catholic Church was going. The priests couldn't possibly change the direction, but the nuns would. So we'll wait and see.
The nuns have it.
David, would you go next so I can keep Natasha to talk about the future workforce?
Well, I'm sorry for the late substitution with John Monks. One of my first experiences, this will take up about half my slot, at the TUC was in the 1960s, and some of you remember the names involved. But George Woodcock was the General Secretary, and at about 4 o'clock one afternoon, his secretary said he wanted to have a word with me, and he said, "You're on the next train to Wolverhampton, here's the file." So I got to Wolverhampton, but unfortunately, deliberately or otherwise, nobody had explained to anybody in Wolverhampton that Woodcock wasn't coming. And I looked around, and there was a Rolls-Royce outside the station, And there's an AU official who's the current mayor of Wolverhampton with his chain of office. And he looked straight past me, naturally, and I said, excuse me, you're looking for Mr. Woodcock? And he said, what's that to thee, lad? And I said, well, I'm afraid I'm sort of deputising and getting car, lad. See? So I go in the car to the town hall, and we go in the green room at the back. And he said, barman, double gin and tonic for lad here. He said, now settle you down, have a drink, and I'll go up on platform and tell them that Woodcock isn't coming, so if anybody wants to leave, they can leave now. So I was naturally more and more relaxed as this evolved, and he came back off the platform. He said, they're all still there. He said, follow me. So I go like up these steps here onto this sort of scaffold, and he said, sit down there, lad. So I sit down, and he gets up and he speaks in an old-fashioned oratorical style. He says, ladies and gentlemen, as I was in a position to intimate to you only a few moments ago, the Right Honourable George Woodcock, Order of the British Empire, is unable to be with us here this evening. However, it gives me the greatest pleasure to introduce Mr. Victor Feather. So I had about 1/100th of a second to decide what my next move was, and I decided I'd plough through this speech, which I did, and it was all right, and I answered some questions at the end, and with much relief got the next train back to London. And about 3 days later, Feather's secretary said he wants to see you. And so I go in to see Mr. Feather, and he says, sit down there, lad. And so I sit down. He said, now then, lad, I hear you've been impersonating me in Wolverhampton. So, anyway, I think this is one of those subjects where you can say almost anything and get away with it. But, no, seriously, there is the question of the overall level of employment, and then there's the question of the composition of employment, etc. And it is a daunting task to say anything particularly astute about all of the possible things that one could wish to address. But let me put up one or two markers from our TUC perspective. Beginning right at the start with what Lorna was saying, of course, is absolutely 100% agreement on that. I mean, we have been, in the last 10 years in particular, giving very, very great emphasis to these family-friendly policies, not only because the increment of the labour force is predominantly women, but because we are well aware that we will not be able to deal with the problems of parental leave and maternity leave and so on unless we have some good agreements to put these in the right framework. If I may say something good about Europe, it's the European Union framework which has enabled us to do all these things. Equal pay 20 years ago was a European idea as much as it came from domestic roots, and there's a lot of case law now about that. If I can bring you up to date, not only do we have the parental leave directive just coming through, and the maternity leave now on the statute book, I'd just point out that these were through social partner agreements in Brussels. That's the trade unions and the employers actually agreed on these things, and that's the reason they are on the statute book in Britain. Part-time workers have been mentioned. The reason that is now on the statute book in Britain through the transposition of a directive is because we negotiated it in Brussels. And I'd just like to put in a wider plug for the European model, because in this employment debate, people often begin by extolling the virtues of the American model as if the European model is self-evidently a second best. I don't agree with that at all. I'll explain why we've got a disparity in levels of unemployment in a moment, but just let me remind you that the European Union over the last 30 years has caught up with America by having a higher level of productivity growth. The reason why the gross product of Europe is now the same as the gross product of America, in total, per head it's still ahead in the United States, but in broad terms, the reason why Europe is now as big as America in gross product is because we've had a higher growth of productivity, that is output per person. Now you can't have it both ways. When America has been growing, I'm talking about over 30 years now, not the last 2 or 3 years, any 2 or 3 year period, the statistics may point in different directions. But over a 30 year period, where America has had a growth of jobs of over 1%, it's not because they have had a much higher rate of output growth, but because they've had a lower rate of productivity growth. And the fact is, America has now got a trade deficit, a structural character of $300 or $400 billion a year, and that's matched by a European trade surplus. So it's not that Europe is weak. We have a different structure of employment in Europe, and Britain is roughly halfway between the European type and the American type. America has not done better on skills generally than Europe. I think that they have a better record of employing people insofar as they have a higher degree of inequality, and incidentally they've got 2%, is it not, something like that, of people in prison or otherwise as it were not counted in the statistics, but they have a very high degree of inequality. Now we have to get the best out of the European and the American systems, but the first basic macroeconomic point I think has to be made about employment is we do need economic growth. I'm afraid that those people that still want to contend that the environmental considerations means we don't need economic growth, I'm afraid that that is not how the economy actually works. Of course we want to improve the environmental quality of growth, and I've personally been heavily involved in the environmental debate through the round table since Rio, but we do need a certain rate of economic growth. And the basic problem in Europe, on the continent in the last few years, as opposed to this country, is that since the fall of the Berlin Wall, they've had it the other way around. They haven't had sufficient economic growth, and so we've got to deal with that. Now, on the question of whether it's better to have much more short-term employment rather than permanent employment. I mean, it is actually not the case that there has been a major shift towards short-term employment. I'm not sure Mr. Reid was implying this, although often it is felt that we've now seen the end of the permanent job. Can I just mention a couple of statistics on this? In 1984, 83% of people worked as permanent employees. Today the figure is 80%, so not much change there. 80% of people work as permanent employees. Since the mid-1980s, the average time people stay in a job has not changed, nor has the share of long-tenure jobs changed, or short-tenure jobs. And recent research suggests that about 40% of men are still in jobs which will develop into long-tenure jobs. The more exotic and unusual forms of employment, exotic in the sense that the new types of employment, teleworking, job sharing, home working, are actually, at the moment, still very, very small minority. And the rarest breed of all, the professional portfolio worker, is likely to remain so. Now, I only throw that out because I'm sure it'll be a subject to David for discussion as to whether we are totally moving to a different sort of employment. Certainly, all the differences, changes that Lorna mentioned are true. And we have to reconcile a new balance between work and family life. We've got the increasing contradiction between people having to work very long hours, often unpaid, while at the same time we know that although the unemployment statistics overall are only 7% or something like that, one in five households has no work. And that's because of the concentration in particular households. Just in the concluding couple of minutes, because one's got to be pretty selective in a short presentation, can I say something about how we see the argument about work changing and David's, your own interest in the Millennium Dome and all of these new challenges and how to present them? There is the argument that it's an exciting world to have changing jobs as long as people have the skills to move around. And that it follows from that, I think, that people need to be disabused of thoughts about job security. Or indeed even that employers have any responsibility anymore for their staff in this context of job security. And we certainly think that that is far too simplistic. It is certainly true that more people will be involved in this kind of lifestyle for at least some of their working lives. But a job for life has always been a bit of a myth. The truth is that most people have always had a number of jobs, and it's easy to exaggerate how much this has changed. We do not deny that this is one trend in the world of work. It suits many and we're not hostile to it. And I believe unions have a role in helping such people, as they already do in such sectors as arts, entertainment and journalism, where this has always been routine. But it does not reflect reality for the majority, and it ignores the experiences of other groups in the workforce. Those who move around between dead-end, low-paid jobs and are the most vulnerable to unemployment. The many who stay with the same employer for a substantial period, though they need to upgrade their skills. Those doing solid, necessary jobs, many in the public sector, but by no means exclusively so, they will always need doing, often in caring and in hospitality, etc. So we don't really need this evangelic sort of tone, no more jobs for life, everyone will be flexible. All of our researchers in the trade unions show that people really do want to have some quality in their contracts of employment. The main job of the trade unions is to try and improve the quality of the contracts of people's employment, as well as obviously, the number of jobs. And I can assure you that although trade union membership has fallen, partly because of the changing structure of employment, and it's quite hard to provide these improved quality contracts of employment, that is overwhelmingly, surveys show, what people actually want. I'll just conclude by demonstrating the nature of this by a musical story, which is supposed to be based on an experience of Sir Thomas Beecham. Sir Thomas Beecham was unusual in always wanting three rehearsals before a symphony concert. Most people do with two. But after all, he couldn't be denied, being Sir Thomas Beecham, and in the second rehearsal of this particular symphony orchestra, he noticed that only half the people were the same as the people in the first rehearsal. And in the third rehearsal, he looked round and there was only one person, a trombone player, who had been present through all three rehearsals. So after the rehearsal, he went right up to the back of the orchestra to this trombone player and shook his hand and said, I want to thank you for your loyalty, and you're the only person in the orchestra who has been with me through all three rehearsals. That's quite all right, maestro, says the trombone player. I'm only sorry I can't be with you for the concert.
Thank you, David, very much. Natasha Andrews from Unison.
Good evening. Basically, I'm here representing Unison. I'm not actually a union officer, I'm actually a lay member. I am vice chair of their National Young Members Forum, so hopefully that will actually give me some sort of picture of what young workers do want today and perhaps what they want in the future. I was called here to speak about the future workforce. In order to do that, I believe that obviously I need to talk about the situation now with young people. I mean, I'm 24 at the moment. Hopefully I'm still a young person. Perhaps people younger than me, I'm probably not. But I think about that, about people who are older than me, so that's right then. I work at Queen Mary in Westfield, another University of London college, in the School of Medicine and Dentistry in Whitechapel. I used to work at King's College. I am a university graduate, I've got a degree in politics, but like many university graduates now, you can't necessarily think that you're going to come out and do something necessarily relevant to your degree. With the increase in student debt, you have to literally come out and really just get what you can, unfortunately. Not saying that I don't like my job, I do, but I mean, I would love it to be relevant to my degree. I obviously work to earn money, like all of us do. However, lucky for me, because I work in the public service, I was able to join Unison. Unison actually helps me and many other young members to contribute back to society and back to the community where we live. And there's a growing young, as my colleague from the TEC did mention, there has been a fall in Unison, a union membership. Unison is the largest union in the TEC with over 1.3 million members, which is always a good sign. There's a growing number of young people in Unison and in unions as a whole, which illustrates, I believe, a growing trend of young workers giving back to society, which perhaps does draw away from the fact that everyone does believe we are the fracture children, fracture generation. We don't necessarily think for ourselves, and I'm certainly not all right, Jack. Being in Unison, and being in unions in general, I believe, does help empower young workers. So much has been taken away from young workers over the years. As a chairperson of my branch, and you will find that many, many young people who are on our young members forum, there are people of 23 and 24 who are branch secretaries. They're in positions of power, they can negotiate with management at very high levels at what many people think are such a young age. I'm also a steward. I represent clerical staff, I represent porters, I represent cleaners, I represent dinner ladies, and most of them are older than me, but I'm respected by those members, which is a lot more than most young people are at work. I am respected in my workplace. I'm very lucky, being in higher education and having a strong union, they've been able to negotiate that respect for me. When I meet fellow young trade unionists, I see them fired by the strength of their beliefs. They're proud of their professions. We represent nurses, we represent porters, I say clerical staff. They're proud of their union, they're proud of what their union does for them, and they're proud of the role that they play in society. It's a very rewarding position, being in a union. I would say that I will not say that I've never been confident, perhaps more confident than most. But before I actually joined, because of just graduating from university, very unsure of your job security, Being the union has given me so much empowerment. I've got the confidence to stand up here and speak before all of you, which is about anyway. I make many friends. I meet so many different people. I see so many promising young people. Hopefully, I mean, we are the future of the trade unions. Perhaps I will see some people that I meet in my day-to-day life sitting in David's chair soon. Who can tell?
You're welcome.
But not only do I believe that young people have got the right to work, I believe that they should have the rights when they're actually in the workplace. There are many issues for young people at work. Obviously, for trade unions such as Unison, there's the issue of the minimum wage, which was highlighted by our event in Newcastle on April the 10th. There were 20,000 people on that march, and the majority of those were young people. We had an event afterwards attended by the majority of young people in this country, showing that trade unions can be relevant to young people. We can reach out there, and we can heighten our membership, and we can give young people the respect that they deserve. Minimum wage, obviously, is a good thing. We don't deny that. It's good it started somewhere. However, what we do disagree with is obviously the two-tiered system. And what we are totally disgusted with is the fact that there are young people who don't actually get it at all. Because you're young, it doesn't mean that you eat half as much food, or no food, perhaps. It doesn't mean that you live in half a house. It doesn't mean that you live with your parents. I mean, we see day after day that we see young people are having younger families. Surely they should be paid for their role in life and their role at work. Young people, due to this continual undervaluing of their worth, are more likely to suffer much bad behaviour at work, like low pay, like bullying, like racial and sexual harassment, or harassment on the grounds of sexuality. And because they of being offered low-paid jobs, they're too scared to speak out, and they tolerate it, and they shouldn't have to, and they shouldn't tolerate it, basically. Young people have got the rights not to be bullied. Young people are more likely to be bullied at work, which would lead onto this horrible, vicious circle of not being satisfied at work, and therefore going on from job to job to job, continually undervaluing yourself as you go along. Young people are being told things like, you weren't brought up properly, you don't dress properly, and they end up feeling cut off everywhere you turn. Now, I know this because this was said to me in a job. And I can remember that, basically, I mean, unions are very heavy on, stress at work. Now, this did cause me a lot of stress. I was quite ill. And I can remember, and I don't mind admitting this, that I remember I was off work for 3 weeks, and I cried at the thought of going back to this manager. I was totally scared of going back. I mean, I'm lucky I've got another job now with a lovely manager. I'm sure she'd love me to say that. obviously, that leads on to good health and safety also, which is obviously the stress and so on and so forth. But young people are so unaware of their rights, which leads to, once again, civil education. We're great believers in civil education, whereby young people are made aware of their rights and they're given the strength to stand up to bad employers. Bad employers will always undercut fair employers, and fair employers will always undercut good employers. And we have to remember that and encourage those good employers to give their young workers the training and the respect that they deserve. In my own sector, I work in higher education, obviously, you do find casualisation of employment. I was on a 3-year temporary contract, which, although I know they wouldn't have done, they could have given me a week's notice. Not necessarily after 2 years, because normally that does allow you the month's notice, but it does worry when you stare down at your contract and it's got this temporary nature about it. I mean, this happens with young people also at work. Even if you have got a long-term contract, you'll find that the small period that you have to work to actually prove you can do the job is lengthened and lengthened to basically keep a certain temporary nature about it. We find many fixed-term contracts. Many people used to think you did a fixed-term contract and you could, perhaps sneak onto full-time staff because everyone would like you and they wouldn't want to lose you, and you find that less and less and less. I believe that in order to produce a successful generation of workers for the future, we've got to provide our young people, we often see now, time and time again, about the level of education and the low level of reading abilities. I could read. I remember being able to read from a very, very young age. and being quite confident in my learning abilities. I mean, I'm one of those few people that actually like going to school. Let's see. But you find children don't less and less because they're growing class numbers, and there's also that onwards sort of like plough to actually go and get that job when they're seeing that young people aren't being respected now. Let's say 13-year-olds might have a part-time job now, say as a newspaper round, and they see people slightly older than them not getting the minimum wage, for example, and they think, well, what's the point of standing on at school? I mean, they went to school, they're not getting paid, well, so on and so forth. I believe that we need to provide them with a decent free education, quality training and a living wage. We should encourage this country's young people to realise their aspiration, achieve their dreams, because at the end of the day, young people have got just as much right to work and to be respected as work as anybody sitting here.
Thank you, Natasha, very much.